listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
It began with an informal group of about a dozen physicians and engineers wanting to invent new medical devices desperately needed by patients. Now 15 years since its launch, Stanford Biodesign has trained more than 1,000 graduate students and nearly 200 fellows. The program has been renamed the Stanford Bayer Center for Biodesign and is moving forward with an emphasis on creating new health technologies that not only benefit patients, but also take into consideration the economic challenges of healthcare today. In this podcast, we'll talk about the success of the program with Paul Yock, Biodesign's director and a successful entrepreneur himself. Yock is a professor of bioengineering and of medicine at Stanford and was a founding co-chair of the Department of Bioengineering. Paul Yock, thank you for joining me on One to One. You know, we were talking a minute ago about Biodesign, the 15 years, and you were saying, you know, how surprising it is how much traction it's gotten. Can you talk about that traction and that surprise?
Yeah, well, pleasant surprise. So one thing we didn't anticipate is that there would be universities around the country, around the world, that would pick up on this kind of training process. We did write a textbook, and that's become widely used. But even within Stanford, the fundamentals of the process that we teach, that is starting with a need first and then developing a technology after you understand the need, that's kind of spreading around. I hear a lot of people talking about that now.
And when you say, and you sort of smiled when you said that, because I presume that people think about getting something before they think of the need, creating something before the need. Is that the difference?
Yeah, we tend to be ready, fire, aim innovators, right? So we are all trained from the time we're little kids to solve problems. It's a reflex. And the people who get to universities are really good problem solvers. The trouble with that is that we don't have a discipline about picking the right problem to solve in the first place. And that's the essence of what we're trying to do. We're saying, look, there is a step-by-step discipline in understanding what you should invest your time and energy in solving. And that's in a nutshell of what we're doing with the Biodesign process.
So take me back to 15 years ago. This started sort of informally, a discussion among faculty, School of Medicine faculty, engineering faculty. What was the genesis? What was the spark?
That's exactly right. Let me talk about sort of my personal story just in one quick respect, and that is I lucked in, when I was here training in cardiology, I lucked into a mentorship situation with a couple of folks who had been on Stanford faculty recently, John Simpson, Tom Fogarty, now world-renowned medical technology innovators, but I happened to be at the right time at the right place to work with them. So after being away for a while, came back to Stanford in the 90s, there were a number of us gizmologists on the medical school faculty.
Gizmologists, that's a great term.
Yeah. Well, you know, folks who
Is there a science gizmology?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're working on a degree, a PhD in gizmology. But a group of folks, Stanford had attracted these people anyway, right, who were kind of inventors, would-be engineers on the medical school faculty. And we started talking as a group. And then what happened was that BioX started forming. This is late 90s. BioX was forming up at the time. And there was this turmoil about what BioX was going to be. And those of us gizmologists said, look, if this is a broad life science initiative that has in mind translational impact, there should be a unit that reflects medical technology innovation, what we all love to do. And so we pitched that basically to the leaders and the deans, and long story short, they said, yeah, that makes sense. Let's have a unit. And we named ourselves BioDesign to align with the BioX nomenclature, right? We were the X was design of medical technologies for us. That's how that name came to be.
Did you, as a cardiologist, often find yourself in your career thinking, only if we had this? Is that how you came to this gizmology expertise? Were you often thinking that way?
I did. I mentioned being mentored, and the reason I needed mentorship was that there were a couple of things that I saw as I was starting my career. And I was an interventional cardiologist, angioplasty, stenting, and so on. There were a couple of things that clearly were missing, and I thought, oh boy, we need a solution here, and that started me. I invented some things and started a company and so on, and that's what got me into this business of trying to train in biodesign.
So talk about the startup. 15 years ago, you start this, and you're basically a startup in the conventional sense of the startup. What were the sort of the early hurdles that you had to overcome, and what were some of the early surprises?
Well, one early hurdle was we really didn't know how to do the training process. So we were sure that it had to be genuinely interdisciplinary. It had to involve physicians and engineers. And we knew that it had to be experiential. We knew that the best way to train in this area was actually to do a real project. But we didn't really have a process in mind for training. And we were very lucky early on. We reached out to a local, highly successful med tech entrepreneur, a fellow named Josh Macauer, who had been in a big company, had experimented with different training processes. He was at a stage in his career where he wanted to take this on. So together with our founding group, he helped us create the first fellowship program. We picked four physicians and engineers, put them together in a team, and kind of made up what we were doing going forward.
And then you basically, as I understand it, the fellows were chosen, the first group of fellows, and then you basically said go into the hospital and find out what's needed and basically be investigators and be snoops and be the sort of medical investigators and walk around and see what the needs are. Is that sort of the process?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the first part of our process is completely observation. It's interesting, you know, it's a kind of design thinking, right? Design thinking is this powerful method that also says, look, you need to start with what the user wants, right? Apple is famous for understanding what users want. So that's powerful. The trouble is that the complexity in healthcare is that there's no simple user, right? There are stakeholders, and the stakeholder matrix is incredibly complicated. It would be wonderful if you could design just for patients or just for patients and physicians, like a consumer product. But you have all these other stakeholders. You have the hospital, right, that purchases technologies and regulates what gets in. You have the payers that have a different set of criteria.
Insurance companies.
Insurance companies and Medicare. You have the regulators. We are more regulated than any other industry, right? We have the FDA, and then you have all kinds of other stakeholders. The press is, of course, intensely interested in what happens with medical developments. You have physician societies. You have, you know, the business concerns. And then this is all changing with Affordable Care, Obamacare, in a crazy, profound way, right? So the stakeholder landscape is really complicated. And that's, I went through that just to say that this observation process that starts what we do in biodesign is critically important, and it is harder and more detailed than a usual consumer product needs finding.
Which doesn't go through the regulatory process, which doesn't go through the payer system, which doesn't.
Bingo.
As you said, Apple creates a product, they put it out. Does the consumer want it or do they not want it? They purchase it, they...
That's exactly right. There's a, you know, in a lot of product design, there's a thing called a minimal viable product, right? You do something quick and put it out, and you see how people respond to it. We can't do that, right? We have to get it right, because it may take 8 or 10 years to get through the FDA and to get reimbursement, and you can't change it during that process, right? So this is really important to understand that this is a fundamentally different design process, and it's front-loaded with understanding the stakeholders well enough that you can invent something that satisfies all of those stakeholders.
So the fellowship is how long is it?
It's a year.
It's a year. So they go into the hospital, they look for needs, they come back, and what's the remainder? What's the process? What's the continuation of that?
Yeah, so we require them to come up with at least 200 needs. And these are, as I mentioned, they're not only the hospital, but they're digging into reimbursement issues. They're looking for economic areas of needs. They're thinking about FDA. So all of those stakeholders that I mentioned. So 200 needs. This, by the way, that phase of the process is a brainstorming process. It's open mind, you know, take anything in that looks like it might be interesting. First phase. Second phase, then, is filtering down those 200 into a few really meaningful, impactful needs that, if you solve them, would have a big impact on healthcare. So that phase is where we get to use all of our critical judgment and faculties, right? That's a hard phase, and that's another couple of months of just boiling down the 200 to the 3-4 really profoundly important needs.
And what's the rigor of that? Can you talk about that, how tough it is?
Yeah. A couple comments about that. One is one of the things we learned over the years is that this is the hardest, psychologically the hardest part. This is where our teams start to develop stress. We actually have a shrink, a psychologist, who does team dynamic work with us and works with the teams during this. It's really hard.
Is that because people get attached to ideas? What's the psychological stress part of this?
The biggest stress, this is a subtlety, the biggest stress is that to do this process, you are operating with not enough information about any of those needs, right? You are, to understand those 200 needs fully, would take years. Mm-hmm. And so what you're doing is you're forcing this team to use kind of the wisdom of the group, their instincts, and just enough research to cut needs off from the bottom, to take the ones that, and so it's an intensely, especially for type A achievement-oriented engineers and physicians, to be making decisions in an incomplete information environment is really stressful. Mm-hmm. But there's a trick here, which is in order to get through that process of filtering, you have to spend enough time with the surviving needs that you really learn those needs well. So you are forcing the teams to slow down at the need stage, not inventing yet, and spend enough time that you really know the dimensions of those needs well. So when you get to those final 3 or 4, you are a master of that need. And we'll talk about the next step, but the next step, the inventing step, turns out to be vastly easier and more successful if you've slowed yourself down on the need phase.
So you drill down to 3 or 4, mm-hmm. and then the next phase is the pre-invention stage.
Well, next phase is really inventing, right? Mm-hmm. So you take those needs in, and we develop, as part of the needs characterization, we develop criteria for what a great solution would be. So what are the three or four things that a great solution has to have to meet that need? And we do those in advance of brainstorming, and that becomes a contract that the team has with itself, which is, we're not going to pursue a concept unless it meets these criteria. It's another piece of psychology, because inventors, especially young inventors, fall in love with their inventions. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way of, in a organized and honest way, going back and saying, okay, does this invention that we're getting a little later really meet these criteria? So the next step is going into inventing. And here we use design thinking methodology and invent several solutions to each of those needs, at least two different approaches. Again, to mitigate against falling in love too easily, right? Mm-hmm. So the teams will go and they'll have multiple brainstorms around each need that's going forward. And then at this point, we filter again. So 3 to 4 needs go into brainstorming. There are 2 to 3 solutions for each of those. So you wind up with a dozen, you know, different inventions. And then we make them compete again, those dozen. And now we bring in hard filters. So now we look at intellectual property. Most companies are surprised that people who do this for a living in the business world are surprised that we leave intellectual property so late in the process. But we insist on that just because we think knowing the patent landscape too early can shut you down from really creative inventing.
Out of fear of the complexity, out of...
No, it just short circuits your thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, if you see something that looks like a really good idea, mm-hmm. you lock on that. Mm-hmm. And you say, that's the only
guaranteed.
Way to do it. Yeah. So you gotta not look at that stuff before you invent.
What are the characteristics of the fellows that are important? Clearly, as you go through these steps and you talk about the psychological aspects and giving up and all of that, you know, what do you look for in the characteristics of the individual fellows?
Well, it sounds a little corny, but we are looking for fellows who convince us that they will be leaders in health technology innovation later on in their careers. And so, you know, this is a combination. The interview process is brutal. We do 2 days of interviews for the fellows, but we get a feeling for their leadership skills, their ability to work in teams, their, of course, overall intelligence background. And then there's one other thing. And that other thing is there has to be an inventive spark that we see. And so these the right person hasn't been able to stop herself or himself from trying to invent stuff. You know, you see it. It's maybe in their PhD work. It's maybe, you know, on the wards they've said, you know, this is dumb. I want to do this differently. They generally have not succeeded in what they've tried. But this characteristic of I've got to invent something is the spark we're looking for.
Do you find that when you talk to them that if you go back and you trace to their young teen periods or when they were, you know, children, that there was always that sort of, they were taking things apart, they were breaking things, they were starting things, is there that impact, that sort of developmental spark when they're kids?
So I don't believe that's true. So there is a spectrum of folks. I think there are just developmental differences in when this manifests itself in people. And I'm deeply suspicious of the, you know, stories that you know, when this kid was 3 years old, they were taking apart the iPhone and, you know. Mm-hmm. I think some of our fellow applicants purposely write that into their applications because mm-hmm. we have this cultural myth that that's mm-hmm. that's who inventors are. Some of our most fantastic inventors didn't have that kind of childhood pattern. And I do think one of the big points is that this kind of innovation is actually a process. It's a mm-hmm. process that can be learned and practiced and perfected. I'm sure we can take people who don't really think of themselves as inventors and help them become inventors. And I also think we can take good inventors and make them better.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talked about the crazy and profound way in which the Affordable Care Act has changed the dimensions, can you talk more about broadly about that and about how you have to look at the economics?
Yeah, this is a huge point. So just to rewind a little bit, until the past few years, it was basically the case that if you invented a health technology that really made a difference in patient care, it would get paid for. The government would pay for it. The insurers would pay for it. It, in some sense, was a crazy system, right? Where what other technology sector is like that, right? Where you just invent something and people will buy it. It is. Health economists will say that that's one of the major contributing factors to this rampant escalation of healthcare costs that we've had. So this has all changed profoundly with our awareness of the escalation of healthcare costs with the Affordable Care Act. And it's now the case that there are deep restrictions on new technology uptake, most particularly with the payers, with Medicare and with the insurance companies. It's a lot harder now to get a new technology approved. So what that means is that we have to change the way we're inventing, the way we're training inventors. And this is the biggest thing that we're doing now at BioDesign. So, you know, engineers and physicians who have this inventive spark that we talked about typically have not paid a whole lot of attention to health economics. And in fact, a lot of them don't like that stuff very much, right? But going forward in their careers, it is absolutely essential that they understand the economic forces that are going to shape whether an invention is going to go forward or not.
So how does that change and impact the program itself? How has the program changed post the Affordable Care Act and the demand for more fiscal accountability?
Yeah. Well, the change is deep because in our first, 10 years anyway, we just did clinical needs finding. By that, I mean we'd go into the hospital, we'd find an important clinical mm-hmm. need, invent a technology, and it would get taken up. We are changing our process in a major way to do clinical and economic needs finding together. So we are now teaching our fellows to look for value signposts. Where are there areas where healthcare is costing too much and technology can make an impact? A couple of examples. If you look at an episode of care, so a patient experience through getting sick and getting well, and the technology piece of that is a big part of the cost of the care, that's an area to look at to say, do we need that technology? Can we invent something more interesting that bypasses that expensive technology? Or another example, if you look at a disease condition and there's tremendous variability in how technology is being deployed across the country or around the world, that's an area to look at and say, okay, we can take costs out of the system by being smarter about our technology innovation. I'm actually hugely optimistic about this kind of inventing because we've never really tried to do it before. Mm-hmm. I think it's a huge lever that we can pull to help control costs.
What are you most proud of in the 15 years? What do you look back and say, these were really substantial changes we've made, or...
So, for sure, what I'm most proud of is the careers of the alumni who have gone through the program. So we have a number of startup companies that folks have. We just had our 41st startup company come out of the program. That's great. Those people are doing fantastic things. They're impacting. We are well on our way to having 1 million patients treated just by things coming out of the program directly. But more than that, we have folks who have gone out into existing companies and who are changing the way that these big strategics, these big companies, are doing their innovation. They are doing now needs-based innovation. We have a number of the big companies, names you'd know, who have implemented biodesign programs internally with our people doing it. We have folks who are on faculty across country. We have 9 of our alums on faculty at Stanford alone, and many others at you know, the big name places who have started biodesign programs at those places and are training inventors. So it's the people close to 170 alums now, and it's a little army of folks who are doing this innovation process.
Talk about the patients for a minute.
Yeah.
The patients, you said more than 1 million patients have been impacted by the discoveries and inventions. What are some of those most significant and tangible?
Yeah. So just to clarify, we are approaching 1 million just from the inventions from within the program. If you look at our alumni inventions and add that in, it's much, much larger than that. But so examples, I'll give you examples coming from within the program. Probably the one that has impacted the most patients is a thing called the Zio Patch, which is a smart bandage that records your heart rate. And the reason that's important is that you go to your doctor, you have fluttering in your chest, and you're concerned about whether your heart is acting up or not. Your internist will listen to you, get an EKG, and of course, since this is an intermittent problem, it doesn't happen in,
right,
in the doctor's office, right?
Right?
Yeah. So, but your internist is worried, thinking, "Boy, this could be something really mm-hmm. serious," right? So, your internist sends you to a cardiologist. Same thing happens in the cardiologist's office. Nothing is going on. Cardiologist also says, this could be serious. Sends you to a rhythm specialist who attaches this kind of very clunky tape recorder that you try to wear for a week, but you can't take it in the shower and so on. So anyway, not only is it bad for the patients, it takes a long time to get this recording of the heart rate, but the costs are there's a ka-ching at every point, right? Internist, cardiologist, and so on. So fast forward, the Zio Patch is a little bandage that can record your heart rate very accurately. So when you see your internist and you say, "I've got skip beats," your internist reaches into a drawer, says, "Wear this." You wear it for a week or 2 weeks. You break it off like Netflix, send it in. It gets read. Boom, email goes back to your internist right away. So you've taken weeks out of the diagnosis. But more importantly, most of the time that rhythm is going to be innocent. And you don't have to see the cardiologist. In fact, it's like 95%+ of the time. So this thing cuts all of that cost out of the system. Patients love it. It's much easier. It's a good example of combined clinical and economic needs finding.
And it fits really well into that CMS
exactly.
reimbursement.
Exactly,
because
right.
Because exactly what they want to cut down on is waste and over-testing, et cetera. So what about the future? I know that you have a program in India.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking elsewhere around the globe, and how do you hope to expand around the globe?
Yeah, so we have a number of partner programs. Our deepest involvements have been in India and Southeast Asia. We have a program centered in Singapore. And our MO has been to spend time developing programs like that and hopefully transition them to an independent status. And that happened in India. So in December, we did a handoff And the federal government of India is sponsoring the continuation of actually five biodesign centers in India that use our process, and that's great for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that there have been a number of companies created over there, and so we're able to send Stanford students over to get an experience in what's a startup like in India, and it's been terrific. Going forward, we have a lot of countries now who want to work with us, and we're in the process of developing different partnerships. So we just opened up a three-year program development partnership in Japan with three universities who were teaching this process to. The faculty are training with us. And it's a good example of how we're trying to be strategic about where we go. So Japan is really interesting in that they have the same demographic problem that we are headed into, namely the aging population and what to do about. They lead the world in terms of having a problem with managing elderly folks. And they also are leading the world and having some of the big technology companies there realize that this is a problem and deploy smart home technologies, robotics, other interesting approaches. And so this will be a win-win situation. We believe they'll benefit from the needs-finding approach that we teach. But we're getting a glimpse into what this problem is like with aging at home. We are also looking at our experience in India was very gratifying in that dealing with underserved patient populations where cost constraints are really profound is an important bit of inventing culture for us to absorb. So inventing in that kind of an environment is stimulating, challenging, and there are lessons to be learned. And we're in the process of thinking about another environment like that, not ready to announce anything, but so we will continue to have partnerships like this. We have catalyzed the development of consortia of universities who teach this process. So there's one in the United States, there's one in Europe. We will in September launch the one in Asia. These folks all, use our process, our teaching materials. Besides the text I mentioned, we have an extensive video library that we provide open source to all of the folks teaching this process. So we will both try to be broad in our impact globally, but also develop these key strategic partnerships that we think will help us understand some of the evolving needs globally.
So when you think of the 15 years, what are you most surprised about and gratified about and gratified for?
I think the scale of the impact that the process has had is way beyond what my expectation was. And, I have to say that, we can't overstate our influence here. I mean, I think we've had an important catalytic role. I think this was happening, this kind of collaboration was happening lots of places, and lots of places have contributed. But given that, still, it's staggering how many places, wherever I go, I hear about the biodesign process, and I think, well, wait a minute, we made that up, that's very gratifying, and of course, it all comes down to patient care, right? So if we do our job right, lots of patients, billions of patients, are getting impacted with new technologies that can be delivered at a reasonable cost to the system, and that's hugely gratifying.
Paul Yock, thank you for joining me in One to One.
Pleasure to be here.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.